You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 242.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. You have reached another Local Maximum. A very good kind of a palindrome episode today, 242. Aaron, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
All right. And look, as you notice, we have the soundboard working. So this is back to, back to my old days at Yale Radio, where I could turn up and down sound. If we get into an argument, I can slowly turn down your sound and win the argument. It's great. So hopefully
you don't go full Jim Cramer with the big red button. And...
I don't know. You might be next week. There might be a much bigger soundboard, and then we can see what happens with that. All right. Let's get through this quick because we've got to watch Game of Thrones House of Dragons coming up tonight. So I'm enjoying that so far. So glad you'd come over for that and an episode.
Does anyone else use the acronym HOTD? House of the Dragon, but abbreviated to HOT D. I feel like nobody should use that abbreviation for the show.
I still call it Game of Thrones. I don't know what else to call it. Anyway, all right, today we have a couple of, so I checked the, we're already getting off track, aren't we? I checked the...
there was a track?
I checked the tech news this morning and all throughout the week. And usually sometimes it's very slow news week, particularly in August.
Well, but August is over.
August
is
over.
The drought has ended.
A lot of stuff has been happening in the world of tech. And so basically a lot of it is I like to cover stories that we've covered in the past as like a continuing saga over like this decade. So we're going to have we're going to talk a little bit about the state of censorship online. We have one quick update on self-driving cars, and we're going to start off today with this headline in the New York Times. And I actually think it's one of the few maybe not ridiculously written articles in the New York Times, but it's just a plain technology article about how an AI artist won an art prize. I should have looked up what art prize it was, but it was one of those that where you submit.
Yeah, it was a judged competition of some sort.
Yeah, it was a judged competition of some sort, and the person who submitted it was Jason M. Allen of Pueblo, West California. The big quote here is, "I won and I didn't break any rules," the artist creator says. So I like that quote. Continuing on with the New York Times, I'm just going to read not all of it, but some of the things that I think were important that popped out of me. One entrant, Jason Allen, didn't make his entry with a brush or a lump of clay. He created it with Midjourney, an artificial intelligence program that turns line into text, into hyper-realistic graphics. The name of the piece of artwork is, in French, apparently, Théâtre de l'Opéra Spatial is how I read it, but I don't know if that's correct. And for those of you who are in video land, you could see the piece right here. You see it here?
I do. I've seen it in a tweet earlier this week.
I can kind of show it up to the screen there. Maybe we can have that edited and put it in.
We'll definitely have a link to that in the show notes.
Yeah, yeah. Honestly, I don't know what the big deal is. Like, if I passed this, I wouldn't be like, wow, that's an amazing piece of artwork.
It's certainly better than I could do, but that's a pretty low bar.
By far.
Neither of us were taking any art classes in high school.
Right. We'll get to the end what I think this means, because I do have some thoughts on it. Let me just keep reading. These apps have made human artists understandably nervous about their own futures. Why would anyone pay for art, they wonder, when they can generate it themselves? They have also generated fierce debates about the ethics of AI-generated art and opposition from people who claim that these apps are essentially a high-tech form of plagiarism. Mr. Allen, 39, began experimenting with AI-generated art this year. He runs a studio, Incarnate Games, which makes tabletop games, and he was curious how the new breed of AI image generators would compare with the human artists whose works he commissioned. This summer, he got invited to a Discord chat where people were testing Midjourney, which uses a complex process known as diffusion to turn text into custom images. I'm actually not entirely sure what they mean by diffusion. I might have to look that up for next time, because I'm sure it's a technique that I am aware of, but probably have never heard that particular phrase before as a machine learning engineer. Very interesting. Users type a series of words in a message to Midjourney. The bot spits back an image second later. I think we're going to not talk about the tech here, but more about the meaning of it, which we have covered the tech of some of this stuff in the past. The quote, "I couldn't believe what I was seeing," he said. "It felt like it was demonically inspired, like some otherworldly force was involved." So when you find something that's demonically inspired, apparently you just want to have more and more of it.
And he didn't even claim to have sold his soul at the crossroads for right. the ability to create this amazing piece of art.
So one weird thing about the article, there was this final quote at the end, which I think might be sarcastic on his part, like not an actual...
The demonic one? Or,
I think a lot of his quotes are sarcastic, is what I'm getting, like kind of reading between the lines. But his final quote is... And he, the final sentence of the article is, "And he urged artists to overcome their objections to AI, even if only as a coping strategy. This isn't going to stop," Mr. Allen said. "Art is dead, dude. It's over. AI won. Humans lost." So that was the last sentence. And I don't know. You could probably.
So I didn't read the article myself, although I have heard some chatter about this.
Give me a hot take.
Online. But I have a question about the format of the article. Did they actually interview this gentleman, or are they just citing his tweets? Because that changes the context dramatically for some of these statements, whether they were having a direct exchange with him or if they're just saying these are things that he tweeted or posted online about the experience.
No, it was they talked to him by phone on Wednesday. So they spoke to him.
Real directly. Journalism.
Yeah, they spoke to him directly. Fortunately, it's not so much of a political topic that there are people who I know they know when a newspaper calls them, the newspaper is going to write something completely opposite of what they said.
That lowers my prior for how much this guy is trolling and just putting out shit takes.
Right.
But it doesn't completely eliminate it, because there are certainly people who would take absolutely that tact when speaking to a New York Times reporter. Yeah.
Well, right. So despite what he said, I actually disagree with his last statement, which might be sarcastic. The whole "art is dead, dude. It's over." First of all, he was engaging in a form of art I don't think he generated this piece by like on a single take. I think he had to learn the technology. He had to run things over and over again, and finally curated one that he thought was the perfect piece, which I think, I don't know if we talked about this. Actually, we talked about it on the tech retreat. I don't know if we talked about it on the,
the
tech retreat show. But it was like, a lot of the work in terms of coming up with this AI generated art is going to be the curation of that art, and it's also going to be very difficult to do. I mean, look, if the world is going to be flooded with these so-called they're images from AI as art. They're not going to be worth very much on average, you know, because they cost almost nothing to create. So it's almost like, okay, there might be some oohs and ahs at the beginning as the technology gets good. But I think that, you know, one day it'll be like, okay, this is very easy to generate.
Well, I think that's exactly why people are worried is not that, you know, people are going to unlock huge value with these as much as this is going to drive down the market value of a certain... kind of mid-range band of human artists who are producing, you know, work on spec or you know, work on demand, you know, kind of maybe a lot of the, you know, Fiverr graphic design type folks that if they can be replaced with this algorithm, then the amount that they can charge for their services drops through the floor.
It's possible, but look, I think that...
That's the concern, sir.
Right. When I think about these issues, I kind of look for, I try to find historical analogies, and I look at, well, did the movie theater kill live theater? No, not really. I don't know what it did to theater salaries, but did video kill the radio star?
Did it kill it? No, but you see a lot more people going, well, at least before COVID, you had a lot more people going to see movies than you did buying tickets to the opera. It changed what the market for things like live theater was. It became a much more niche and so.
Okay, but so you're talking specifically about the you specifically mentioned mid-range people, like not the people who are art geniuses or like people whose art sell for very high amounts of money. It's more the people who are like
technically proficient, but not necessarily famous or not about to be displayed in a prestigious museum.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I mean, that's that's the type of person who's like, who could just learn the technology because they're not.
So let me draw another parallel, another analogy here. Let's think about sports for a minute. Okay. And so this is in my mind not unlike in sports when we have performance enhancing drugs come on the scene and performance enhancing equipment. Like in swimming, there was a big deal a couple Olympics ago about the shark skin suits.
Right.
And so there was one Olympics where the U.S. team and maybe a couple other countries had these really new high tech swimsuits, and maybe it was only shaving fractions of a second off their times, but it was enough that it gave them a distinct advantage. And then in the next Olympics, they banned that particular or highly regulated that particular material and that particular suit type.
Interesting.
So I think you're going to see, it begs the question, what is our objective function here? I think just like in athletics, we're going to see new rules and regulations. He said he didn't break any rules, and that's because they didn't think they had to have a rule for this.
Sure.
And to be fair, I'm pretty sure the category he was in was like digital art. So it wasn't like he was passing this off as I drew it by hand. It was more that they didn't realize that he was using some augmentation here. So either we're going to see, separate divisions.
Hold on, I want to make sure. Oh, my microphone's working. Okay, I was unclear for a second. Sorry, go ahead.
We're either going to see the development of separate divisions for assisted and unassisted art in the digital realm. Or we're going to see rules outright banning it in certain circles and competition. It demands the question, what is your objective function? If you're looking for the coolest, most interesting, most innovative art, why do you care whether it was done by a person without the assistance of AI, or if it was a collaboration, or if it was, I don't know if anything can be said to have been purely AI generated in these contexts, but why do you care if you're assessing it on its aesthetic qualities?
Yeah, the guy on Fiverr, those people might be using this technology, and so it's not like they're like, oh my God, my artwork is so pure, and no, they're there to make money.
And to bring it back to the art world away from that sports analogy,
right?
I'm sure there was outrage when the first computer animated, because the first computer animated movies were certainly couldn't pass for the equivalent of hand animated. That there was, there's kind of, uncanny valley is not the right term for it, but there was a clear distinction of this is not the same thing. But
what about Toy Story?
So it definitely, I don't think anyone was fooled anyone thought that that was done by hand, but they weren't going for a hand-drawn aesthetic. Whereas here, I think he wasn't trying to do a new form of art that is distinct. He was mixing this in with,
it's trained on artists that were that particular.
So this is maybe more like, if you're a sculptor, working in wrought iron, do you have a electrically powered forge, or is it an old fashioned coal powered forge, and does that make a difference in the maybe it makes a difference in the material properties of the output, but the aesthetically, should that matter for the quality of the metal sculpture that you're generating there?
Yeah, I mean, it's just going to be another method, I think, is the thing that we can do.
And to get to his possibly facetious statement at the end, where he says art is dead. There's a lot of talk. You see it more in film and literature that, you know, the author is dead. That from a point of critique, that the work needs to stand on its own. It doesn't matter what the author was thinking or, you know, their life experience, that analyze the work as it stands free on its own. And so I think it would not be unfair to say the artist is dead, and it doesn't matter if the artist was, a hermit who lived on a mountain and made his own paints from, you know, the berries he found on the mountainside, or if it was generated by an AI-assisted process, that the artwork stands on its own, the artist is dead.
Another question I have about this article is they quote, like, unnamed artists who are very, very upset about this, but we don't actually hear about, like, who they are, what they're thinking. Maybe there aren't that many, or maybe it's just people who are upset that they lost the competition and are giving some examples. So I don't know what the...
I could certainly understand feeling miffed if you spent, you know, several hundred hours working on a particular digital art composition for this, and a guy who just...
he probably didn't spend several hundred.
Who at least, the way he's pitched it, you know, just... pump some words into a text prompt, beat you at it. It certainly feels unfair, but like I said, why should that matter?
Yeah, what? That's life. Although I don't think the future. Yes, artists are going to have to adjust. It doesn't mean everybody is going to have to be using AI assisted programs, depending on what that they're doing. Particularly if you're like one of the high end masters or whatever, but. That is life. You have to adjust to new realities. So
we may have talked about this in passing on the show before. I can't recall. One of the things that was mentioned in the article was talking about the concerns for, you know, the plagiarism implications of a tool like this.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That in the way that if I were to take, you know, for example, a famous piece of artwork and slightly modify it for my own thing.
Right.
Unless it falls into the category of, you know, of parody and satire, that's not protected. That I have basically I've taken their intellectual property and I either can't do that or I owe them something for having done that.
Yeah, so it's like, but if I've trained on it, is that the same as other artists looking at it?
The thing with this is that you can't necessarily identify a direct lineage. This exploded in the recording industry, where there are so many cases of both lawsuits, but also then just, you know, things not necessarily even going to court, but people having to pay royalties because they sampled something or their beat is similar enough that they weren't they didn't think they could win the case for not having to owe another artist for that. What's happening here is that because you're basically sampling from everything all at once, it's so diffuse what that source is. Maybe that's where diffusion comes in here. That you don't you can't identify who would be owed anything, and so nobody gets anything. And it raises an interesting question: if you're stealing from everyone, are you stealing from anyone?
And also, is it more taking? What's the difference between stealing in this case, quote, stealing, I don't know if I consider stealing, versus just taking inspiration from?
Yeah, well, I'm sure I'm butchering the quote, but there's something about, you know, good artists, study their influences, and great artists just steal.
Yeah.
Art, like everything else, you know, we stand on the shoulders of giants. I would be hard pressed to say that something is truly, you know, original in a vacuum.
Sure.
So how far do you want to push the limits on that?
Yeah, yeah. All right. So this is an interesting story to follow over the next few years. I think, you know, as these types of things flood the market, like with DALL-E and stuff, at some point there's going to be some aspect of it that's just going to become less interesting. Yeah. And interesting thing will be to see what comes up to the surface as being a permanent part of the landscape.
With both the graphical ones and with the you know GTP3 and related products,
yeah.
We've seen there's been a big drop, and then there's kind of some interesting incremental improvements, some bigger than others. But my question is, when's the next big jump going to come in this? Will there be a big jump?
Could it make video? It should be able to make GIFs if it could do.
We don't have a story to talk about this, but I have heard a fair amount about both audio and video deepfakes popping back up in the news again. And yeah. and so that's an area to watch for.
Yeah. I mean, it could also be, you know, a kind of altered video of some news item. Now, I mean, the Biden speech was not altered, but I can see it being altered automatically.
I've heard some theories. I don't know how deep down the conspiracy well there are that some of the footage being put out was being tweaked on the fly. Not that they were changing what he was saying, but to alter the visual perspective.
Well, I think one of the news networks kind of tilted.
They did like a color shift.
Yeah, so it looked more like pink than yeah. blood
and,
red.
And again, this is not a topic that's on our agenda today.
No, it's not.
But
it is concerning. But I don't want to. I feel like if I'm going to talk about that, I better like do a solo show and be like.
I will mention one thing it seems like it was an own goal on the folks who were doing the set design, the staging for this, in that there were red, white, and blue stage lights.
Yeah.
But the angle that every news camera seemed to have taken only showed the deep red.
That's interesting, because I read a bunch of commentary saying this was, for whatever reason, this was the look that they were absolutely going for. But it could just been an accident.
Yeah. Is it Hanlon's razor or Occam's razor in the case here?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
Not today's topic.
No, well, it is today's topic. I mean, it'll be, will it be out of the news in the future? I mean, I things are getting crazy out there, man. I don't know what to tell you. And I've been trying to avoid it on the show. I feel like it's not avoidable anymore. We have other things to talk about today.
Thank you for the reminder, though, that I gotta do my primary voting this week.
Oh yeah. Well, I'm in New Hampshire here, so I'm across the board. I have to wait till September 13th. That's a very different.
It's right around the corner.
It is right around the corner. It is right around the corner. Okay. I just looked at my ballot the other day. There's so many names in it. I've got to do so much research. Okay. Let's talk about this Cloudflare controversy, because I had barely heard of Cloudflare. This is really important, I feel like, and it's also a news story. It's one of those news stories that you'll see the headline, and I think it'll go over everyone's head. It went over my head. I had to dive into it a little bit. So there's some controversy involving a company called Cloudflare. So the first thing you ask is, like, what is Cloudflare? And then you find out it's a reverse proxy. And you're like, oh, incredible. This makes sense now. And then you ask, what the hell is a reverse proxy? So I looked it up. And I'm familiar with parts of it known as a load balancer when it comes to, you know, networking or server. So essentially, let's start at the beginning when you make a request over the internet, you go to something.com, it goes to a namespace thing, it says, okay, this is where something.com lives, and then it hits that server that's owned by the person who owns something.com.
That's DNS, right?
That's the domain name. Domain name turns the name into a number. A number is the address. Like, it'll turn Aaron into your home address, for example, if I'm trying to go there. So then it goes to the address. It finds the server that lives there. And that server gives it the website. Now, what most companies do on almost every website, they will have a server that sits in front of that server. So almost think of it as like, you know, you have a guy in front of your house.
Well, is it like a P.O. box? Is that a good metaphor?
I think it's more like it's you have a guy in front of your house maybe it's a club and there's like a bouncer. And these reverse proxy servers are kind of like the bouncer. So it will say, hey, it'll, you know, in some cases be a load balancer. Say you guys go over there and you guys go over there. So one server doesn't get too crowded. In some cases, it will turn people away. Hey, I think you're spam. I'll turn you away. By the way, I'm doing this analogy on the fly. I think it's working pretty well.
But I like it because one of the things when you're running a party is that the guy at the door, he's got the little clicker. So he's keeping track of how many people come in and how many people go out.
Right. And it also does some stats, and it also has a little bit of information like, for example, let's say you have like a static page that someone wants, a page that never changes, that's like a real tiny bit of text. It'll just return that text and not even go to the server to do more complicated website stuff, because it'll be like, you know, maybe the bouncer at the door is like, you just need to get, I have your hat from last night here. Yeah. I don't know. That's not a good idea. Or no, you're just asking, hey, how late are you open? You know, or something like that. So you don't actually have to go in. So it does things like that. So this company, Cloudflare, is available to be your reverse proxy server and load balancer. And that's kind of, I think that's the main thing that they do,
yeah,
as their business. So it's part of the cloud.
But a big piece of that is protecting against DDoS.
Right, right. So that's the kind of spam. That's like DDoS is when... Let's use the club analogy again. When, I don't know, thousands of people show up trying to get in to cause trouble, and you can kind of turn them away.
Was Cloudflare? If I'm hearkening my memory back, I feel like there were several. Was with the whole Parler incident and Gab, like, so it wasn't reverse proxies that.
So that's
that
the difference.
That backed out on them. Yeah, it was something else.
That's why this is an important story, because in that story for Parler, it was Amazon Web Services that shut them down. So that was like their actual server shut down. The club itself was shut down. Whereas in this case, it's just the guy at the front of the club being like, "We're closed." if it's still that's why it's a fundamentally different form of censorship.
When your reverse proxy drops you,
yeah,
which I'm getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here, yeah, but when that happens, is the result the bouncer at the door just tells everybody, no, the club's closed? Or is it the bouncer at the door says, I'm done, I'm going to pack up, I'm going to go home, doors are wide open, have fun?
No, because that's the address you
can't get in without the reverse proxy.
Right.
It's not that they're just like no longer protecting it.
But it's also a very clunky way to shut down a website. We haven't even got to what website they're shutting down yet. It's a very clunky way to shut down a website because if your entire site it goes down, like those servers, then there's not much you can do. But in this case, you could just get a new proxy
server.
Right,
you just hire a new bouncer.
So that's kind of Cloudflare's perspective until today, which was just like, look, it doesn't really do much good for us to start deciding who should and shouldn't have our services. And honestly, that's not the business that they're in. And they heard, they stood firm on this.
Yeah, they're taking a common carrier perspective, yeah, so to speak. Yeah.
So
if memory serves, I believe they have in the past shut down two major websites this way before. But those were pretty clear and clear outliers. I think one of them was Stormfront? It was one of the
Does that still exist?
Well, I think they're one of those websites that's you know kind of gone from host to host to host into the darker and darker parts of the web, but it's still out there, I think.
Yeah.
And the other was, I want to say 8chan possibly. It was 8chan. One of the chans.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
And
so that makes sense.
But I think even earlier this week when this story was developing, they basically said, yeah, we've done that in the past. Those were outliers. We don't want to do it again. And we don't think that this rises to that level
You're about to hear some very similar statements coming out. So it's been under pressure to block this site, Kiwi Farms. And at first, I thought felt really bad for the farming community.
Who doesn't like kiwis?
Yeah, I know, but I've never heard about that. But that apparently, that's not what Kiwi Farms is. I don't have I didn't go into the whole thing of researching them. I assumed I didn't want to go down that rabbit hole. So for the sake of discussion, I'm going to assume that it's a 4chan-like thing.
Yeah, well, and I think it very much falls into the category that when you're talking about free speech cases, which no legal action has been taken that I'm aware of, but this is very much in that vein. Your defendants or your victims tend not to be the most sympathetic
Correct.
Individuals or organizations. And that's just the nature of the beast, because popular speech is not controversial and doesn't need to be protected.
Yes.
So I'm not at all surprised that Kiwi Farms, whatever it is they're doing, this wouldn't be happening if somebody wasn't a little bit PO'd at them.
Well, yes. So they claim in the article that if Kiwi Farms wasn't shut down, people are going to die. Now, I hate that we're at this, but
have you seen the, I think it was from Reason Magazine, some of their video shorts. Yes.
People will die. That guy's great. Right. I hate that this is where we're at, where it's like, before it would be, oh my God, people are dying. Let's do this. And now it just seems like the phrase, if you don't do this, people are going to die, is just the speaker is asking, what do I need to say to get this person to do what I want them to do? And so, it's often a lie, which is really terrible now. It's like, you can't.
Yeah, the odds of it being hyperbole seem extremely high.
Yeah. Okay, so Cloudflare Inc. blocked Kiwi Farms on Saturday, days after hinting it will continue working with the controversial discussion forum. Despite weeks of pressure, the company has blocked Kiwi Farms content from being accessed through its infrastructure after an escalation in rhetoric and specific targeted threats over the past 48 hours. CEO Matthew Prince said in a blog post, "This is an extraordinary decision for us to make, and given Cloudflare's role as an internet infrastructure provider, a dangerous one that we are not comfortable with," Prince said. "While we believe it would have been appropriate as an infrastructure provider for us to wait for the legal process, in this case, the imminent and emergency threat to human life, which continues to escalate, causes us to take this action." Then there's a bunch of stuff in the article, which I will post, about how bad Kiwi Farms is. They claim that the community is causing people to die from suicide all the time. How often do you see people encouraging other people to kill themselves online? Because I see it like all the time. That's why I feel like the internet is so toxic. I managed to insulate myself from
those parts of social media. So yeah. I have not seen it, but it's something
Reddit,
I've
seriously.
Heard of.
It's on Reddit for sure.
Well, almost completely unrelated, but I'm now curious because I didn't catch the name of the CEO previously, but you said, was it something Prince?
Yes, Matthew Prince.
Matthew Prince. Now I'm really curious if he's related to Eric Prince, who I believe is the founder and head of Blackwater, which goes by has gone through several different names. But I don't know. It seems like probably not, but you never know.
Yeah, it's a common name.
But what I think an interesting thing to make note of here is that what we've seen with them in the past week is that they've said, we absolutely will not cave to this pressure. We absolutely will not. There's no chance that we will, right up until the moment that they say, and we have caved to this pressure.
Yeah.
Which is a little bit reminiscent.
Because people will die.
Of some of is the which... language that I'm going to hit on a sensitive subject here.
Yeah.
That you see with crypto companies. When they say that we are highly liquid, there's nothing to be worried about, our books are completely stable, and they will say that up until the moment where they say, and we're locking up it so no one can make withdrawals.
Right. I mean,
so things collapse slowly until they fall apart.
I don't think this is a collapse, more of a victory for a pressure campaign.
That's probably overly dramatic terminology on my part.
But yes.
And every time they bow to this, it makes it much more likely that they will do it again. Because now people are going to point not just at those two exceptional cases, but here's the third.
Yeah.
And so it becomes much easier to justify doing it again and again and again.
It's interesting.
And opens them to some legal liability on that front. That if you say our policy is we absolutely will not cave into this, short of actual, judicial intervention. If the courts tell us to do XYZ, then we will abide by that. But short of that, we will comply with the law and are not subject to other pressure. Mm-hmm. Once you start making exceptions, then you can't stand strong by that.
Right. Because in this case, they had to be the court essentially to determine if what the pressure campaign is saying is accurate. And so, and we don't know.
Yeah. Well, I can't judge from the amount of information I've been privy to whether this is them giving in to public pressure, or is this is them doing a thorough investigation and realizing, oh no, yeah, people actually are going to die if we don't do this. And even though we wouldn't necessarily be legally culpable, we don't want that on our conscience that we are morally obligated to do X. That's possible, but that does not, they have not made a compelling case for that one way or the other.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds possible, but I'm kind of doubtful. In a statement Saturday, Clara Sorrenti, who has been leading the charge to force Cloudflare to terminate services for Kiwi Farms, would be interesting to look to see, you know, what her background is. I don't know. Said the move deals a big blow to Kiwi Farms and their community. If the site ever becomes active again, the campaign must continue fighting and pressure other companies that provide services to it, she said. Cloudflare, which as recently as Wednesday suggested it won't cede to pressure to terminate Kiwi Farms as a customer, defended its earlier policy, saying that the legal process is still the correct one to deal with revolting and potentially illegal content online. Still, in the absence of a mechanism for providers like Cloudflare to work with legal authorities over threats to human life, the company was forced to take this uncomfortable emergency decision alone, Prince said Saturday. He warned it's likely Kiwi Farms will find other infrastructure providers and that Cloudflare's decision to block the site may heighten the emergency. The company will continue to work with law enforcement authorities to help with their investigations into Kiwi Farms and the users who may have posted illegal content. So, I mean,
I'm very curious when they say that moving to another provider may heighten the emergency. I don't understand what they're implying.
Why is it worse when?
Yeah.
Because now they can't shut them down again. But I mean,
but you did.
Yeah.
Unless this is a tortured reading of the by driving them deeper into the dark web, it's more difficult to monitor what they're doing. But I don't think that's a reasonable read on what's happening
that,
here.
That is a very strange sentence, and you're right. It is kind of poorly written here in the article because
to touch on your earlier comment about those who are driving the campaign to have them. Deplatformed is maybe the wrong term, but to get Cloudflare to drop them as a customer, I have heard some accusations about some of the groups behind that movement. I have not done any research to confirm those, but I think both sides are going to be doing a fair amount of mudslinging here. Yeah. And if you're saying that you know they're literally killing people, then you know a lot of things can be justified, and if that is indeed your stance.
Yeah, I mean, I think here, Clara Sorrenti, Gen Z, Canadian Twitch streamer, transgender activist, and political commentator. She's one of those. She's a gamer.
I don't want to dig too deep into this, but the words I've heard thrown around are that that people on Kiwi Farms are going after quote unquote groomers, and then people who are involved in those groups and communities are then trying to get Kiwi Farms shut down. And I don't know whether either side of that is accurately portrayed. That's the problem
with the news these days.
Because if you look up Kiwi Farms, you know, before the show, I was looking up Kiwi Farms on Wikipedia and, you know, the header on that basically says that, you know, they're a gathering place for extremists to harass and persecute people in certain minority communities, which, may be true. I doubt that's how they would describe themselves, but that's certainly how some people see them. So
yeah.
Neither side appears to be covering themselves in glory here.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've covered our fair share of like, you know, crazy people in the news. And so I'm kind of tired of doing it. I don't want to,
there's a lot of they said going on.
I know it's always like two kids fighting. I mean, I don't know. You have two kids, but it's always like he started it.
There are moments when the zero tolerance policy that some many schools have adopted where it's you guys are fighting, you're both grounded, suspensions all around. I don't care who started it. I don't care who the bully was. I don't have time to deal with this. All you both go to a corner.
Yeah. I don't know if that's
it's tempting. It doesn't solve anything.
Yeah, no,
but
it doesn't.
But it's a lot easier for me to.
Yeah, yeah. All right. So my questions also revolve obviously around the nature of the threat from this website. Is it real or made up? You can never tell. Those are the questions raised. Again, we're not going to fully investigate. I mean, I hate how we come up here and we say we don't have all the answers, but that's always true. We don't have all the answers, but we know what questions to ask, which yeah, I feel
but,
like is
important. But it'll be interesting to watch what Cloudflare how they follow through on this, where Kiwi Farms lands in terms of other providers, you know, kind of what that landscape looks like, because at a simple level, it should be Cloudflare's right as a business to choose to terminate any customer they want.
Yeah.
Where it becomes a bigger problem is if there's collusion within the industry that all of the reverse proxy providers all of a sudden blacklist them, then there's possible concern there.
Right, right. So
that really gets back to the same problem we were talking about before with like when Amazon Web Services, you said, you know, dropped, what was it, Parler or Gab or whatever, and basically nobody else would host them, and so they had to go out on their own and build their own infrastructure.
Correct. Well, actually, yes, that's true. And so I have a bunch of related stories about the whole question of, you know, how free is information flowing on the internet and where are the cloggages and what's good and what's not good. And I chose this story as the main one to focus on because I feel like this is technically new, not technically in terms of like,
it's happening correct, at a different layer of
exactly,
the stack.
Exactly. But
a layer that most people don't dedicate any thought to.
Right. Right. But I do want to point out there's been a lot of news about both Twitter, Facebook and Google recently, and I just want to do the headlines real quick on this whole issue.
Lay it on me.
Yeah. So for Google, for their Play Store, apparently Parler is back in. Truth Social still, they're still thinking about it.
So the interesting thing about the Google Play Store is that Google can control who is in or out of the Play Store.
Correct.
But on Android, you can sideload things.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so whereas in the Apple Store, different story.
Right.
If there are ways to get apps onto your iPhone other than the Apple Store, it probably involves voiding several warranties.
Yeah. Well, Truth Social is available on the Apple App Store. I don't know about Parler yet. They might be having the reverse policy now. It used to be they worked in lockstep. Now they seem to be kind of having mixed messages here, which is sort of interesting. There might be like sort of a crack in the wall. FBI and Facebook, yeah, that's an obvious one where Mark Zuckerberg said they spiked the Hunter Biden story by basically slowing down its users' ability to see those posts because the FBI essentially told them to. Now he says the FBI didn't mention that story, but the FBI came a few days before and said, we think there's going to be a story and you got to watch out for a story that looks like this. And then when that story popped up a few days later, they were like, oh, that's definitely it. So he almost sounded like he was manipulated by the FBI. That's the whole thing.
And that sounds very reminiscent of how, with the phone companies, police, whether it's, you know, federal or local level law enforcement will tell them, we'd love to have the following information. We don't have a warrant, but we would love to have it. And sometimes, you know, some organizations will say, screw you guys, come back with a warrant. And some will say, oh yeah, sure. Here it is. Have it.
Yeah.
Have at it. And they don't tell you as the customer that they've forked over what you may have thought was your private information. So there's kind of a weird gray area where, private companies cooperating with the government, handing over your information, isn't necessarily illegal if they give it. Now, if the government were to forcibly take it without a proper warrant, that would be different, but that's not happening because the companies are cooperating.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And in this case, I feel like, it's sort of like, in some sense, the FBI played it smart here because they gave themselves deniability. Oh, we weren't talking about that story. We were just, you know, but
yeah. It gets real sketchy if we didn't tell him to suppress it. We just said, in our professional opinions, we think it might be wise to do the following. Does that count as the government basically exercising suppressing speech on certain topics when it's A, not a direct order from the government, and B, it's not the government doing it? This seems like a question of letter versus spirit to a large extent.
Yeah, Yeah. And then finally, Twitter. Again, I don't want to spend too much time on each of these. Is this whole this security guy? There's a whistleblower who came forward who was their ex-head of security. Twitter says we fired him because he was so bad. He's like, no, I fired him because I pointed out all their issues. And so you never know. I mean, security professionals in the tech world, I have found, are usually very, very good, but they're also usually the first to say that the sky is falling in terms of security, which might be understandable. But I mean, this goes back to the whole, you know, Musk takeover thing. Yeah. Where he's saying, look, they've done nothing about spam. They have no idea how many of who's a spammer or a scammer.
Yeah, bots.
And bots, and also their security practices are terrible. And it sounds possible, but
I haven't followed
this
story too closely, but I have heard that yeah. this security expert is fairly well known and well regarded in the you know hacker security you know cybersecurity community. And so either this development is going to mean that they've burned all their goodwill, or it's going to mean that they're you know they're speaking the truth and Foursquare. Excuse me, not Foursquare.
Oh my God, what are you doing?
Forgive me, Twitter did them dirty. So that'll be an interesting one to watch.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we could have whole episodes on some of these things. Okay, so we did have that article. So I just wanted to make a point that there were so many wheels turning on all of these different articles. And a lot of this I just got from like the New York Times, basically, which is interesting that this is all in the New York Times. And so we can finish. Well, we have probability distribution of the week. We could finish with the self-driving car story. Do you want to go over that one?
Let's talk about that in brief.
Okay, so that was one of the big self-driving car companies. There's Waymo and Aurora, the independent ones. It looks like Aurora might be sold they float a possible sale, according to Bloomberg, to Apple. Or Microsoft. Yeah,
it's unclear if they've actually talked to any of these potential buyers. It sounds like more that this was an internal memo considering options and possibilities, in which they said that, you know, if we were to be acquired, you know, these are the possible candidates we think who would actually be able to provide, you know, acceptable conditions.
Well, I think, of course, that then there's the question of what kind of sale is it? Is it a sale like, hey, we're not doing well and, you know, we need a sugar daddy to come in and back us up.
Well, I guess the motivating factor here is that the timelines.
There's a flip side to that where it's like we're doing really well. Now we have some technology that people really want.
Time to cash out.
Yeah, exactly.
So it sounds like from what is known publicly and what was accidentally released in this internal memo that I think was intended for the board and went to a much larger section of the company that. They have you know many contracts that they're working on, which the timelines have been pushed out, and so you know money completions that they you know things going into series production that maybe they'd been counting on happening in you know earlier 2023 are looking like they're out in 2024 type thing, and so they've got to consider options for how can we ensure our stability to make sure that we get to the point we can go to series production, which raises some interesting questions. So this is a publicly traded company,
right?
They went public. I think it was through a SPAC last year, I guess.
Such a different world in terms of going public.
You don't think of many publicly traded companies that do not have some form of cash flow. I mean, maybe not all publicly traded companies are making money hand over fist, but usually they have a stable cash flow of some sort that can grow or shrink. And it sounds like these guys are still very much living off of investor money and that infusion of that huge. Don't get me wrong, they got a big inflow of cash with the SPAC, but they're living off of that, and they use the terminology in that memo. They were talking about extending our runway, which is very much startup speak for you. Right. know we have a certain amount of investor money, and by reducing our staff or doing X, Y, or Z, we can make that last 9 months instead of six, and we need to do that to get to the point where we can get more investors or to get to our IPO. But they're past their IPO. They you know, barring something like getting bought out or you know, something like that, they don't have a methodology for a huge infusion of new cash. And it sounds like they have not much they're not selling products right now. So they're in a weird spot. And it's,
I mean, you could still raise money as a public company.
Sure. And that's one of the things that one of the options that was floated is, a offering of, an investment offering to employees to plow some money into the company. One that I thought was kind of funny is they had a line item in there that, we could reduce expenses significantly if we eliminated the, employee, meal program, that'll save us $21 million, which, that is, I don't know how big this company is, but that sounds like a pretty big perk, $21 million in employee meals.
Yeah. I mean, they must have a lot of employees
or some very nice meals.
Yes. They have 21 employees, get $1 million a meal.
And there was some talk of, well, we could spin off, you know, their LiDAR division, I think it is, for $500 million or something. So they have options, but it's interesting to see that
doesn't seem too significant.
It's interesting to see that they're looking at major options here, and
so I think it doesn't sound like they're doing great, and this is something we see across the industry. Snap, once again, I feel like Snapchat is always failing. I don't know how it's like,
my industry, a lot of companies did this. You know, 6 months into COVID, it was that things are going to get tough. We need to look at our options and strategies we can implement to make sure to kind of weather the storm here. And you know, in our company, they made the decision, we don't want to let people go because of this. But that means we're doing a salary freeze. You know, we're cutting back on travel and marketing and some other things, and so that we can get through and maintain, you know, stable cash flow.
Yeah.
And so perhaps this is not an unreasonable thing for them to be looking at, given the truth on the ground, and maybe that whole thing with Runway is just a question of terminology, in that they're coming from a startup mindset because, you know, 18 months ago they were a startup, and so any mature company would be having these same conversations. They just wouldn't be using startup language to talk about it.
It always concerns me when not concerns me, because it's always true, when corporate leaders, they definitely use a language, and I always feel like they're concealing what's really going on, and it's very frustrating. There have been very few business leaders that I've worked with who have really stated it plain, and I appreciate that very much, but it's I think very rare in the industry. But yeah, I don't know what this says about the technology for self-driving cars, because I feel like all of these companies are still very interested in it. You know, Waymo keeps expanding, and you know, if Apple and Google get this company, then that could be a boost to their efforts. Sure. And of course, you know, there's a lot of companies around, so we'll see where this ends up. I feel like where it does end up is going to be very meaningful in terms of where this industry ends up, you know, down the road in the next decade.
Yeah, who the big players are.
Yeah, yeah. All right, which might be a good reason to buy them, because the recession now, you know, is not going to be here in 5 years, unless we're on the verge of the next Great Depression, which I hope not. But I don't think so.
Don't take that attitude. Yeah. Greatest depression.
Greatest depression ever. All right. You ready for the segments?
Let's do it.
And now, the probability distribution of the week.
You hear that? The very probability slick. Distribution of the week. And yes, we have some bumper noise for the segment. Very exciting. All right. So I want to review what we've gone over so far a little bit before today's today's distribution could be pretty simple. In that context, I want to talk about how we've been going over so many different types of finite distributions. That means that there, you know, it's like, hey, we have like the categorical distribution. We have a certain number of categories. They're each assigned a probability. Those probabilities add to one. That's it. So that's not, in fact, this book that I've been studying on my desk, First Look at Rigorous Probability Theory by Jeffrey Rosenthal. Books like this cover infinite sets and like, you know, probabilities that are, you know, not just on real numbers, but that could be on like crazy mathematical constructions. So, but we're still on finite, and there's a lot that you could do with finite, And so we're going to stay on finite for a little bit more. It almost seems like, well, after the categorical distribution, what more do you need? Isn't that all of them? Well, yes, all of them are categorical, but there are certain ones that have
some special cases.
Yes, more of a structure to them. We've gone
categories over, within the categorical distribution, if you will.
So we've gone over multinomial, we've gone over binomial, we've gone over uniform. Multinomial and binomial, you can create those with uniform distributions, and that kind of gives a special case of those, which there's no need to go over. So we still want to go to finite, and I just want to look at some that are like relevant, more relevant in popular imagination versus mathematics. So I wanted to go over the probability of what happens, when you roll a pair of dice. And for those of you, you probably know what those probabilities are. But before we get into that, I want to make a comment about it, because the difference between this distribution of score of a roll of dice versus the other ones we've talked about is, and I don't know if you'd agree with me on this, the other distributions we've talked about, categorical, binomial, uniform, I think that all of those distributions would be something that would be meaningful to all cultures. And not only that, I think those distributions would be meaningful to an extraterrestrial society if they exist. I think it would be meaningful to an extraterrestrial society in a different universe if they exist, because I think it's pure math and it's very, very, goes to the very heart of what probability is and what information is. And since any universe is made up of information, maybe you could come up with some idea where that's not relevant, but I feel like those are very generic in terms of culture and even planet and even universe.
I don't know if I'm ready to jump on that bandwagon, okay. but you saying that seems to imply that the one we're about to talk about maybe isn't in that same category.
Well, of course. I mean, of course, anyone could come up with that, with the idea of a pair of dice and the idea of rolling a pair of dice. And it's not there are certain features of the dice that make it likely it will be that some other culture will come up with it. First of all, if you have something that you roll that you're going to have a random chance, well, you could do a coin, right? You could do a coin flip, and then you could have some polyhedron. A cube is kind of a pretty standard one.
You could spin something like a dreidel.
Yeah. The dreidel or a top, and that can give you any number of different categories. Spin the wheel.
But traditional dreidels are indeed four-sided, correct?
Yes. So so I don't think the idea of a die is necessarily in Star Wars they called it a chance cube, if you remember correctly. but the idea of a cube is also, I think that's one where you have to have a three-dimensional universe. So I think, yes, I think alien civilizations will have a chance cube, probably.
Well, it's very interesting to think why the cube, because those who play lots of Dungeons & Dragons or similar games, there are many polyhedral die, ranging from It's. I don't think it's technically a three-sided die, but a die that you. I think basically you roll a fancy six-sided die for your three-sided, but four-sided upwards to 20-sided is kind of the common upper limit. But then there are some hundred-sided dies and some more exotic ones.
Okay.
So why do many cultures settle on the six-sided die? Why is that most common here? And would we expect that to be the case for non-Terran cultures, perhaps?
So we know, going back to, it was either Plato or Aristotle, someone back then who discovered, or maybe it was Archimedes. I'm not really sure.
Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, one of those Greeks.
Well, okay. There are five regular polyhedra. And that means that they're made up of all the same shape. In the case of the cube, the square, each of those shapes is a regular polyhedron. In other words, you know, each side is the same length and the same angle. And then, you know, basically it's the polyhedral is symmetrical. So it's not like, you know, one side of the cube comes together like this, where three squares come together, but another side of the cube, four squares come together. Right. Like, it's not like that. So there are only five of those shapes that you could make in three-dimensional space. And that's tetrahedron, octahedron, dodecahedron, icosahedron, and cube. So right there, you kind of, any civilization that manipulates three-dimensional space will kind of narrow it down to those five as being pretty special. And of those five, the cube is the only one that really kind of, you know, kind of packs very easily. So I feel like the cube is going to have, is going to be discovered.
You're going to lose a lot of our listeners here who are diehard hexagon fans. But granted, yeah. hexagons don't work as well in three dimensions that way.
Yeah, the hexagons are great in two dimensions. They connect very well. Actually, I might be having a guest that that stores location data, geolocation data on the Earth using a hexagonal Ooh. System. So that could be interesting in the future. Hint, hint, coming up. I do think that a cube would be relevant to other cultures. Now, in other universes, I don't know. That I could be less sure. I'm pretty sure they'll have a binomial distribution. I don't know if
I'm tempted to ask, well, but what if this extraterrestrial perceives the world in four dimensions instead of three, but I don't even know how to conceive of that and what within, the implications.
Yeah, I don't know how to conceive of that within our universe.
Yeah.
So it's possible, but certainly
I'm sure there's the math for it, but I can't.
Yeah, certainly there are humans, you know, humans, and it's just how we manipulate the world. The cube seems reasonable. The numbers kind of work out because we can count to six pretty easily. So, okay.
So this is even more fundamental than, perhaps something like base 10, which if we didn't have 10 fingers and 10 toes, maybe we wouldn't have settled on base 10. Maybe Correct. We would have settled on, you know, base 6 or hexadecimal that's something.
What,
But this is much more of a fundamental feature of the physics of our universe
right.
that you think brings right. us to the cube being kind of a common feature.
Right. Now the idea of scoring the sides 1 through 6 and then rolling 2 and adding those two together, that's a little bit of a twist on it that I think would not be relevant for any independently drawn culture. Although I'm kind of interested to hear if, you know, look, it might be that 2 is just small enough to make things interesting. And that's why I think usually there's 2 die. 1 die, the problem is that every single side is equal, it's uniform, right? 1/6. And so what you want in some of these games is the ability to have an outcome that is very likely, like the 7 in craps. And then you want an outcome that's not likely at all, like the double 1 or the double 6 to get 2 or 12. Notice also another few other points is that, it's kind of like a triangular distribution, which is usually a continuous one, but it's, you know, okay, it's 1 out of 36 is the
snake eyes,
the score of 1, right? And then a score of 2, right? And then a score of 3 is 2 out of 36, and so on and so forth. And so it kind of goes up linearly until you get to 7, and then it kind of descends linearly until you get back down to
1 in 36.
To 12. Double 6. Right. So it goes, you know, it's 1 out of 36, 2 out of 36, 3 out of 36, so on and so forth. As you count up and count down. What was the point I'm making? Yeah, in some interesting games, you want things that are more likely and less likely. It kind of fixes the game. I want to point out that this is not a multinomial distribution unless you care about how you got that total. So if you care, if you're saying, well, I rolled a 7, but it matters if it was a 3 and 4 versus a 2 and a 5, then it would be a multinomial distribution where there would be 6 categories and 2, you know, 2 rolls. But because we're adding them together and presumably in most cases throwing away that information, it's not a multinomial distribution. So it's something a little bit more funky than that. So I thought that was an interesting specialized distribution that is finite, but not necessarily fundamental, but more relevant. And probably a lot of people sometimes say, oh, I didn't follow the probability distribution of the week. Hopefully people followed this one.
Yeah, it's something that we've certainly, even if you've never graphed it and calculated the individual probabilities, you've almost certainly experienced it, since there are so many common board games that involve rolling 2 6-sided die. The one of the most classic being Monopoly, but they're they are legion out there.
Yeah, and so I do want to know. I didn't expect to have such a discussion about the extraterrestrials using playing with dice. So I do want to know what you think in the audience. Head to our locals, maximum.locals.com. Email me localmaxradio@gmail.com. I think we had a good show. I think we're going to call it quits. Man, this has been a longer show than we expected. We can probably break this up into a few shows in the future. I appreciate you coming on. Any last thoughts before we close out?
No, I think this is a good one. I'm interested to see where we go next with the future distributions, though.
Yeah, very exciting. Well, I mean, you do have input on that, so you can tell me. But no. Okay. All right. Yeah. Once again, check out the locals. Have a great week, everyone.
That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week.
Feel the power.